Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Now, I know many of us have heard of yoga and the benefits of yoga, but today's guest has a really interesting insight into what yoga can really do to your body, your mind, and your soul. We have on the show Tiffany Cruikshank. Now, Tiffany is the founder of Yoga Medicine and is internationally acclaimed due to her ability to fuse the two worlds of Eastern and Western medicine together and apply it to the practice of yoga in an accessible and relevant way. She is known as a teacher's teacher and has been teaching for over 25 years. We had a fantastic conversation about yoga, what it can do for your body, what can it do for your mind, and for your soul. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Tiffany Cruikshank. How are you doing, Tiffany?
I'm good. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I truly appreciate it. I wanted to really bring you on the show to kind of go deep into the weeds on yoga. We've spoken to about yoga a little bit on the show, but really have not gone deep into the weeds about the spirituality of yoga, the physical benefits of yoga, the mental benefits of yoga, and so on. I wanted to give the audience a little bit of an understanding about what yoga really is and what it really isn't, because there is so much misinformation and about yoga and what it is, and like, oh, I got to wear Lululemons now if I got to do yoga, and you know, all sorts of different things that, you know, especially guys listening to the, you know, think about yoga like, oh, that's a girl thing, I don't do that. It's hilarious because yoga came from India originally, and it was guys doing it.
Yeah, women actually weren't allowed to for a very, very long time.
For a few thousand years.
I don't know. Kind of ironic now, because it's all women.
Yeah. It started off as a male dominated thing, and now it is more of a female. And in the West, at least, it's more female. But first and foremost, how did you start your journey into yoga?
Well, the short answer to that is I was a troublemaker as a teenager, and I went out on a wilderness program actually, and fell in love with, learned how to survive. And one of my guides was an herbalist, and he took me out on plant walks, and I just fell in love with being able to use our environment as medicine. And kind of soon after I got back from that, there was this little sign near my house that just said yoga and a phone number. This was pre-internet. And one day I just remembered it. I couldn't drive it. I was 14, and my mom would take me. And there was just something about it that I was always very athletic and, you know, active. And so obviously there was a physicality that kind of drew me in. But for me, I was kind of searching, I think, in my teenage years and feeling like most very uncomfortable in my skin. And for me, it kind of, looking back on it, at least, I think it was this kind of coming home to myself. And, you know, as you stick with it, anyone who's done yoga for a while, you know, I think one of the beauties of yoga is that there's layers to it. There's so much you can bind and explore and different dimensions of what you can do. You know, you can really stay on the physical, sweaty, or strength, or stretchy, or more spiritual. You know, there's so many different layers, or even like, I love fascia and looking at how it influences the fascia, but there's something for everyone. And I love that. I love that it can evolve with you over time. And it really for me has. I've been practicing for, I think, almost 30 years now, and teaching. I started teaching soon after because I quickly finished high school. I was so sick of high school and went off to college at 16, and there really wasn't any yoga where I went. So I, on my summer before I went, I took a teacher training. I remember getting like a pamphlet because I don't even know how I got them back then. How did we get information? Man. There were like two options, picked one. Yeah. So yeah, that was the beginning of my journey.
And that was the beginning of your yogic journey. Now, I studied Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, who brought yoga over to the West from India. And can you imagine 1920s an Indian guru walking around looking the way he looked in the 20s with people like, where are you from? India? Didn't even know what India was. It wasn't even like, is that a country? Like, it was such a odd. And then he's talking about yoga. Do you know anything about, can you kind of go back to a little bit of the history of yoga, how it came here from your understanding? Yoga is a very deep, long conversation.
Yes. And I'm definitely not a history buff. I'm more of like a present moment person, but what I will say is I did do my teacher training was actually at the Expanding Light, which is, Yogananda, Kriyananda. And that was my first introduction to yoga, was through that. So definitely steeped in the Yogananda lineage, and very different than I think a lot of what we do, many of us do as yoga asanas today, but I think a great reminder of the simplicity. And I remember they used to do, and I don't do this quite so much anymore, but they did a lot of affirmations, mm-hmm. which was a really cool thing, because now we know with science, like, I mean, we knew back then somewhat with sports psychology, but we're starting to learn more and more just how potent visualizations can be, and affirmations can be, for really changing the brain. And so I thought it was interesting they had it in way back then, but very much focused on meditation and enlightenment. I was 16 years old, and for me that was kind of overwhelming to even think about, but I would force myself to meditate, and you know, for an hour at a time. Can you imagine at 16 sitting for an hour?
Oh my God, at 16. At 36, it was difficult for me. Are you kidding?
I had a little breaking up with meditation. I like forced myself to do it for a few years when I started teaching, and then I kind of moved away from it, which was good because I was able to then come back and create a relationship with it of love and appreciation, rather than forcing myself to do something that I felt I had to do as a yoga teacher. There's something really brilliant in all of the practices. I think each of them has something different. And, you know, if we allow it to, I think it evolves over the decades of our life to suit what we need. If we can become, you know, unattached to this idea of what we think we need. I think a lot of us come to our yoga mat and we think like, I have to move. I have to do chaturangas. I need to keep myself strong. I need to keep my mobility. Or maybe people come for like stress proofing, but there's all these ideas of things we think we need. And for me, I kind of have to unpack all of that and really just see, what do I actually need now?
Now, what, you know, based on a scientific question here, what happens to the mind during yoga, in your opinion? Like, what endorphins, what chemicals are being released? What does it do to your anxiety, to your stress?
I think that's one, it's a really great question. First off, let's just start by saying, I'll set the framework here. There's very little great quality research on yoga, the asana part. There's a ton on meditation and mindfulness.
What's one of the most researched things in the last 50 years is meditation.
Right. And we can see different practices do different things, mm-hmm. potentially. You know, we've got different styles of meditating. We've got stylized thing, you know, like transcendental meditation versus maybe just more simple, you know, focused attention or open monitoring, or, you know, the Herbert Benson, you know, just kind of focusing on the one thing and repeating it, whether that's a meditation or a instrument to induce that relaxation response. But yeah, I mean, the jury's still out on exactly what each different modality does, but we can definitely see that it's enhancing things like GABA, which is a very a calming neurotransmitter, which helps with anxiety and kind of helps us feel more, I always think of it feeling a little bit more grounded with GABA, more calm and at ease.
And that's a real word. And by the way, that's a real word, GABA. That's not a made up word. That's an actual technical medical term.
Yes, it's the shorthand. And don't ask me to say the longhand of that. But GABA, you can look it up. Capital G-A-B-A. Yeah. Yes, a neurotransmitter.
What I found when I did yoga, I don't have a yoga practice now as much as I want to in my mind. It's kind of like you and your meditation when you started out. I'm like, it's like I have to wrap my head around getting into yoga. But when I did do yoga, and I did yoga for a while, the thing I found that was really interesting about it is that when you're doing yoga, you generally are doing yoga. Like there's not a lot of wandering around in your mind. Like you are focused on not falling over. You are focused on trying to get the posture right or the pose right, making sure that you're not, you know, all you can think about is that moment. You are in the moment. And I think that's one of the really powerful things that yoga does, more so than many other kind of athletics or working out, if you will, if you're looking at the physical standpoint, is that you are present like the entire time, almost depending on your yoga practice. But when you're in like these weird positions, you're just like, you're not thinking about your bills, not thinking about your boss. You're thinking about like, this hurts a lot or, you know, so I think that's one of the really great points of yoga. It grounds you and it centers you in the present moment, which very few things truly do that.
Yes. Yeah. I think Herbert Benson was the one that coined that, you know, relaxation response. It's something that you can do that you can repeat that is simple, you know, and repetitive and is non-judgmental. So, but that you can also do regularly over time. So, you know, you can get it when you're playing an instrument, you know, people right. can tap into that if they're gardening, but it's sometimes much easier to get distracted in some of those things. And even I will say for people who have been practicing yoga regularly for a long time, especially if you go to a class that's a little bit more simple and familiar, I guess is a better word. Yeah. Your mind can definitely wander around more because now you're more familiar. Right. And I agree. I think it's one of the things I love about yoga is it's ideally like a guided meditation. The whole purpose is to kind of take you toward that state of being able to sit and meditate and have more of that mental and potentially spiritual equilibrium. But I think what people run into is the challenges of finding a class that's accessible to them, where they can really drop into that, because sometimes we get so caught up in the shapes and the things that we kind of, we start to put this pressure on ourselves. We start to kind of judge ourselves, and then the rumination becomes something different.
Right.
Like, why are my hamstrings so tight? Why can't I do this? I'm like a flawed individual because I can't touch my toes or, I think it takes just a little bit of practice, and I think there's some skill on the teacher's end too, but also on the student's end of, I always like to think of it. I think one of my favorite words is curiosity, is to approach it with curiosity rather than what we approach most of our lives with is this analytical lens of how can I make this better? What's wrong? What do I need to do? What do I need to create? How can I get better? Instead of just welcoming what we find and having this curiosity. I was teaching this morning and I was kind of talking about it as, you know, maybe you'd go on a new hike, you know, exploring the sensations in your hamstrings or in your legs, just like you would, you know, when you go to a new area to hike around, or maybe you go to someone else's home that you've never been to and you're kind of looking, but that ability to take it in, I think the sense of being versus doing, which I think yoga is kind of this fine line in between, because we're doing, and the asana is different than meditation. We're asking you to kind of sit and really be in meditation. But what I love about the asanas is it gives us that physicality to chew on, this thing that we can all relate to. We all have this physical body, you know, in different forms and shapes, but in our own way, we all have this connection to life and to the physical body as an entryway into, you know, the spirit and the mind and kind of how it was all kind of intended. Right. Progression.
Exactly. And it's, I always find yoga to be humbling, no matter how
especially for guys. You know, men always want to like, I must conquer. You can't conquer yoga. Like you can't, you know, you could be the biggest, strongest guy, but the second, but you see this little like 95-pound woman next to you just doing these little things. And you're just like, it is extremely humble. I remember I took one yoga class. I never forgot this yoga teacher. She was, I'm not kidding you, probably 87. And she walked in. And she just walked in like she was 50. She looked like she was 50, but she was 87. She was like the talk of the gym at the time. And she walked in and I took a class with her. It was like a beginner's class too. It wasn't even like a crazy class. It was a beginner's class. And I saw this little old lady do things with her body. And I was like 24, maybe at the time, 25. So arguably like some of the best shape I was ever in. And I was mesmerized at the ability. She was just flipping and so ease. And like, she was a rubber band and it was just fascinating to watch. Yeah. And you see something like that, you're just absolutely humbled, absolutely humbled. And I think on a certain level, I think yoga is built to humble the mind and the ego, because the ego does not like yoga. Ego is like, it does not like it. And it's there to, I think by design, there to kind of break down the ego to the point where you must just give in to the movement, must give in to the pose. And then, and like you were talking about earlier with what it was intended to be, is so many people in the West think of yoga as purely physical, and there is an absolute physical component to it, no question. And we'll talk more about the physical benefits, but it's supposed to, from my understanding, lead to a higher state of connection with oneself, with a higher power, with spirituality, and take you to another place. Whereas if you're doing the yoga, it's almost a meditative movement. Almost. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like I'm not comparing it to Tai Chi, but like that kind of like meditative movement in the positions and everything. And I've seen some yogis do that. They're just like, they're in another place. Like they're not here. They're just another place. I saw this one older, I was watching a documentary. This yogi must've been, he says he's 126. There's no way. I mean, at 126, how can you really tell? Wow. But the dude was old. I mean, he was old, and he was a yogi, and he goes to the river, the Ganges River every morning. Sits and does, and everyone just sits there and watches this guy because everybody knows who he is, and he does yoga, but he's doing something else.
Well, I think, and it's an interesting thing because you were talking about historically, I mean, my understanding, not way, way back, but one of my teachers was Patabi Joyce of the Ashtanga lineage. And he used to tell stories about how, you know, Krishnamacharya would come and do talks, and this is hard to imagine if you're not familiar with yoga, but Patabi Joyce would do a back, he'd start on his knees, this a pose where you bend backwards and grab your heels and put your head on the ground, which sounds crazy, ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's always, it's a deep pose. But then Krishnamacharya would stand on him and lecture and give a talk. But it was part of what, I mean, it seems pretty extreme, but it was part of what brought, it was their way of bringing some awareness and recognition to yoga. You know, the marketing of the time.
And I
think too, one of the things I love about it, you know, like you said, for men, like I've worked with a lot of pro football players and like, you know, they're just sweating and it's so much harder for them, but the humility, I think what you said is such a big part of it, because there's so many components, and whether you come in for physical or mental or spiritual or whatever it is, you're really working on all the layers of yourself. But that humility is such a big part of shedding our ego, which is what ultimately holds us back from really being in the poses. And for me, all the alignment and anatomy that I really love is really just a gateway into this consciousness and the body that we can all kind of experience. We stretch our arms out, we reach through our fingertips. And again, it holds your attention because I'm guiding you through like a guided meditation, but I'm just giving your body something to chew on so that you can really be in it and be there, because the whole purpose is, again, to find this, what you said, this clarity, what you know is often called enlightenment, I think of as freedom from suffering in any form. I mean, whether that's you being able to have some clarity in space or a moment of being able to be present. You know, for me, that I think that's a form of spirituality, maybe a form of enlightenment. I know when I first started hearing about it, when I did my yoga teacher training, it seemed like such a far-fetched idea.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
This thing that, you know, Yogananda did or people did where they could levitate and, you know, were enlightened, and it was this far-fetched concept. But I really think for me, I think enlightenment are those moments where we could tap into something bigger than ourselves, where we can sense into the connection through all people, where we can start to feel the clarity in this present moment without all of the distractions.
Right. And what yoga does, it is a tool to get you there. It's one of many paths as far as enlightenment is concerned. Go ahead.
Oh, and when you say yoga, just to clarify, we're talking about the asanas.
Correct. Physical yoga. Yeah.
Yeah. Because most people include, you know, meditation, pranayama, all these things as yoga. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, and I think in the popular yoga world, think of yoga as the asanas. So,
right. Yeah. When you think of yoga, you're thinking of stretchy and, you know, and then poses, then you're almost about to fall over and all that kind of stuff. Generally speaking, especially in the West, is what they think about that. You say yoga in India, it's a whole other conversation. It's a completely taking it at a different place, but yoga does break down the ego to a place where you can begin to start on a spiritual path, if that makes any sense, because the ego is what stops you from a spiritual path, that spiritual path to enlightenment. And then, and yoga is just it's a hammer. Yoga is a hammer. It's not a subtle way of breaking down. It's so humbling in the way that it does it. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Look, it's challenging to say the least, but like, even when you're doing physical activities, if you're at a high level of athletics where you're a world-class athlete, you are in the moment and you're humbled by the ability to throw the ball or hit the ball, like baseball, one of the most absurd things ever. Like to hit a little ball going at you at 100 miles an hour it's insane. Like 30%, you are a rock star. Like that, what other sport is that? Like, it's really that insane. Yeah. But that is also another humbling, another way of being humbled, but on the physical standpoint. Oh, but to go into the physical standpoint, I've heard so many studies and I've been reading up on the different physical benefits. Inflammation is such a huge problem in our society in general. We are fighting inflammation from everything, from the food that we eat and the stresses and all the things that, you know, most disease, if not all disease, come from a form of inflammation. Can yoga help with physical inflammation?
Well, I think one of the ways we know the nervous system and the immune system is what's regulating inflammation. And we know that the nervous system and immune system are very intimately connected, almost difficult to totally separate. They're both influencing each other. And so one of the obvious ways that I think we can probably all agree on, because like I said, there's not a lot of great yoga research for a lot of reasons. There's a bunch of it out there, but not a lot of it will hold up in the medical community as far as looking at really high standard research. But I think we can all agree on probably the effects on the nervous system and that ability to enhance what's called the vagal tone or the parasympathetic response, basically our relaxation response by training it. And now I'm saying that with hesitation because there are so many different forms of yoga. I believe we experience this in probably most forms of asana, like even the ones you're talking about, the really active ones, probably more in Shavasana, right? When you're able to finally relax, there's this like, oh, I made it.
Oh God. When I'm just lying there at the end, oh my God, it feels like heaven.
Yeah. Versus there's other classes where, you know, the whole class is a relaxation. Maybe there's a restorative practice or a yin practice where you're kind of doing some stretching, held stretches, passive stretches. Maybe there's some pranayama or meditation as well. But I think all of them are going to have a really potent effect on this capacity to enhance vagal tone, this relaxation response. And really, you know, we're not made to be relaxed all day. We want to be able to go back and forth. There's an important place for that, you know, sympathetic stress mode, the busy mode. It's just that we kind of lose that ability to go back and forth. So by retraining that vagal tone, the theory is that we're able to more seamlessly ebb and flow between them. The other side of it that's really interesting, I think, is a newer research in its infancy by a woman called Helen Langevin. I think she's still out of Harvard. I can't remember now, but she's a very well-respected scientist in the fascial realm and for stretching research and acupuncture research, which is my other profession as a Chinese medicine doc. Mm-hmm. But she's done some really interesting studies looking at held stretches. Now, keep in mind, this is, I think, on mice that she was doing it on, mice or rats. I think it was mice.
How was she stretching mice?
And so she was doing this for 10 minutes and they had this contraption where they would, I think somehow they got the legs, and they did this in a nice way.
They forced yoga onto
they had somehow like the, I forget how they did it, but somehow the back legs were, you know, on some mat or something. And then they grabbed their front legs and kind of pulled them into this extended position from head to toe. And so it was a gentle stretch, but they held it for like 10 minutes is my memory now of what the study was, I think, for this one. She's done a few, so I'm getting a little, I might be mixing some of them up, but what's interesting is what she saw was they saw some of the markers for, anti-inflammatory, cytokines, I think it was, in the body.
Interesting.
And as a result of that, now, again, that was after, so a pretty long stretch. They also saw signs of anti-fibrotic. So fibrosis is this kind of like accumulation of fibrous tissue. I think of it like Velcro or adhesions. All your tissues have to be able to glide past each other and move separately. And so it had an anti-fibrotic effect and an anti-inflammatory effect. And now, again, that's preliminary research, but I think it's very important to keep in mind that even just these held stretches, we probably need to stay for a while. Not only are they having an impact on the nervous system and downregulating it, but also maybe on inflammation, which is really important. I'll just jump into another one that was interesting that came out recently, which was on the effects. They just were looking at people who had a regular stretching routine. So it wasn't specific to what they did or how long they did it, but this was an older population, I believe. And they were looking at the effects on arterial stiffness. And they found that the people who had a regular stretching routine had decreased arterial stiffness, which is a huge finding. I think it was a year ago or something. It made a really big splash. In the research world and in my world, looking at, hey, maybe these stretching practices, again, when done regularly over time, maybe are even having effect on the heart and the cardiovascular system, the leading cause of death, right?
It's insane. I always find it fascinating that no matter where we are in the course of humanity, we always think we have it all figured out.
Right?
You know, yeah, 1,000 years ago, you couldn't have told anybody any different. You know, 500 years ago, you couldn't have said anything to any different. And today is no different. And I find it also fascinating that we are now, science is starting to catch up to things that were discussed 3,000 years ago. You know, 2,000 years ago, I mean, they're talking about acupuncture and Chinese medicine. It's been around for 3,500 years or something like that, if I'm not mistaken, if not longer. And yoga, come on. Yoga's been around for over 2,000 years, if I'm not mistaken. And meditation, Jesus. No pun intended, Jesus. but meditation as well. Like, I mean, 50 years ago, people looked at meditation as like, oh, that's some new age hippie stuff. You know, I remember my mom meditating in the 70s. And my Latino family was like, she's lost her mind. She's lost her. She like would get there, sit on the porch and meditate. Can you imagine meditating in the 70s and, you know, a Cuban mother, you know, with a newborn, and she's like, no, I'm going to go meditate. And they're like, what, like it literally would be like Yogananda walking down the street in the 1920s. It's just something so weird. But now science has finally caught up to like, no, everything that they've been saying in the Yoga Sutras kind of is happening.
Although if you had told me in the 90s that meditation was going to be a popular trend, never have believed you.
it's not good on paper. It's not a good pitch on paper. You know, meditation is generally like you're going to sit alone quietly and not think about anything for an hour. Marketing's not good, but now it's different. And now you got CEOs meditating, you've got, you know, mm-hmm. world-class athletes meditating and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. So yoga, that there's lack of research to support yoga's health benefits other than the physical doesn't switch. 10 years from now, it'll be a completely different conversation.
Totally. Yeah. And we're learning so much. And, you know, I think it's amazing that people are into meditation. And if that's all you want to do, great. You know, like the whole purpose of the asanas was to help prepare you, you know, to sit and meditate. However, I do think we're finding, we all know now, as far as, you know, non-spiritual stuff aside, you know, we know how important it is in the health realm, health and wellness realm, just moving. Like sedentary is kind of the new smoking now. So I think what's beautiful about the asanas is it also fills some of the spaces which, you know, our health and wellness, really supporting our health and wellness, allows us to show up better in our lives, in our days, in our meditation. And for me, that's what's important. And I've worked with a lot of patients over the years, thousands of patients over the years. And there's always this kind of feeling of, you know, wanting to get to this place, wanting to feel better or do something or, you know, lose weight or whatever that might be. But for me, what's important is thinking about how it's going to change your life, how you're going to feel, like what are the real tangible changes? Because if I can anchor to that, you know, I can start to see it through. And yoga starts to do that. It starts to work on a lot of the different layers, physically, physiologically. There's a lot of, you know, practices we can do to support organ health and physiological health, nervous system health, you know? So I think there's a really important place for the asanas too, even though traditionally it's like, oh, if you can meditate, you don't need to worry about the other stuff.
it all goes into the same bucket, if you will, without question. Another thing I think that I didn't really think about, and as I get older, you start thinking about things, is something like bone health and how yoga is helping bone health as well, strengthening bones, keeping bones strong.
I think the jury's still out on that one. I mean, I think probably there is a place for some of the other fitness modalities for stuff like bone strength. I think we're going to learn a little bit more about that still, but probably better to do, you know, more impact and resistance training kind of stuff for bones at this point.
At this point. I mean, it doesn't hurt. Add it into your regimen, if you will.
I mean, we know that the connective tissue that, you know, surrounds the muscle connects to the bone and it pulls on it and has some influence. That's the whole idea, right? But from my understanding of the research so far, there's not a lot of support to it having really significant impacts like, you know, plyometrics or, you know, right, resistance training and things like that.
Now on your own podcast, you had a couple episodes on the placebo effect and how that relates to yoga. Can you dig into that a little bit?
I think it's such a fascinating topic because there's a man who's kind of an icon in the acupuncture world, Ted Kapchuk. Mm-hmm. He is in charge of this department at Harvard called the Department of Placebo. And he's kind of spent the second half of his career studying placebo. And for me, he and I'm forgetting the other man's name that runs it too, they have some talks on YouTube. Gosh, what's his name? I'm forgetting his name, but if you wanted to, you could go to the Harvard, you know, Department of Placebo and find them on there and find some YouTube videos, I'm sure. But for me, the placebo effect is the power of the mind, right? Mm-hmm. What we're doing basically, it's such an interesting thing in research. It's something we're always trying to eliminate to prove that our drug is better than, you know, than doing nothing. But mm-hmm. the reality is, even if you think you're getting a drug, and this is interesting, even if you know you're getting the placebo, so they actually give placebo medications that actually have an impact, that actually help people, even knowing it's a placebo. You can buy, supposedly you can buy placebo pills on Amazon. And it just kind of captures for me how potent it is. We talked about, you know, affirmations and visualizations, really capturing that. And, you know, science never questions. We never question the placebo effect, the potency of it. However, they never really think about it either.
Because it just messes up their studies.
Yeah. Which rightfully so, most of modern medicine is focused on keeping people alive. You know, if you're in a car accident, don't come to me, go to them. And then, you know, you want to have all the medicines that are very potent and strong that aren't just a placebo effect. Like
if you're shot, don't meditate.
Yes. but it's undeniable. You know, it's such an interesting thing. There's a book and it's called, I think, The Cure. I think it's Joe Merchant. There's a bunch, surprisingly, there's a bunch of books called The Cure, but the one by Joe Marchant or Merchant, I can't believe I'm butchering that, but that's a great book if you're interested in placebo. She talks all about so many of the placebo studies that have been done. It's a really fascinating area to look into.
And how does that connect to yoga and how, and with the placebo effect?
Well, I mean, I think that's a lot of what we do. I mean, I believe as a healthcare provider, it's, you know, even I think there's a lot of physiological benefits to acupuncture, but I think part of it is also placebo. Mm. We know that people do better when they not only have confidence in their healthcare provider, acupuncture or not, have confidence in it, you know, are on board with it. When I'm training our teachers, I'm always like, you know, make sure that they're on board with what you're, you know, tell them what your goals are, make sure they're on board with it, explain it, educating people, which is what I love doing, whether it's in, you know, the classes we teach online or working with our teachers, that education is also creating the framework of what you might think of as like a healing map. If I understand a little bit about what's going on in any context, you know, an Eastern concept of the body or a Western concept of the body, then I can start to kind of create this map back into health. And so that's one way. I think in yoga, part of it is the visualization. I love to have people, whether that's visualizing qualities or mental affirmations or experiences. In meditation, it's a lot more, but you can do it in a physical asana practice as well to kind of capture that. Like, I guess an example, one example I would say is one of my favorites is when someone's injured or they're unable to do a movement. And this is a great hack for you, for anyone who goes to a yoga practice. Cause at some point, if you practice regularly, there's going to be something that's injured for whatever reason, you know, maybe something beyond yoga that you can't do. And so one of my favorite things, and there's a lot of good science and research behind this in pain medicine now, is to have people sit and visualize doing that thing as vividly as they can, visualize doing it pain-free. I'm creating this neurocircuitry to reshape that pain response over time too. And so there's a lot of different contexts. I think you can use that visualization. I wouldn't call that necessarily a placebo response, but it's kind of along that line of the power of the mind.
Yeah. What's fascinating is that what the placebo does in everything we're talking about here, if it's yoga or medicine or how, making yourself feel better. But what I find fascinating is that the placebo has shown us that if we release the bias or release the negative talk or the belief systems that we have, that our own bodies can heal themselves in a way that is really no one understands. And that's what the placebo effect really does. Because if, you know, I've heard stories of, like, you know, people with cancer medications and some were placebo, some weren't, and all of a sudden the cancer is gone. And it's because they believed it. And then the moment that they found out, oh, that was just a placebo, it came back like the next week or something like that. And they were free for like a year or two. Things like that, you hear these kind of stories. And it's fascinating. We haven't even scratched the surface of what we can do for ourselves if we're just able to. And I think that's the purpose of meditation, yoga, and going down that spiritual path to quote unquote enlightenment is to release the ego, release beliefs, release kind of like take off this, the gunk of the physical world, if you will,
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's like what you first said there was like the mic drop. I was like, we could just be done now. Exactly what you said. Right. And it's so true. And I actually, my second book that I wrote, it's called Meditate Your Weight. And it facades as a meditation for weight loss book, but really what it's about is changing how we see ourselves, the relationship to food, to exercise, mm-hmm. to how we see ourselves, all the things that you're talking about that I feel. So my first book was about optimal health and was, you know, a cleanse and had yoga and meditation and nutrition and stuff. But what I found was that there were a bunch of patients. There was all this great news with the internet now and a lot of people who did all the right things that just never felt great. And, you know, besides our unrealistic expectations around body image and things in the media, forget that aside, you know, just to be healthy again. And I found that one of the biggest hangups was how they saw themselves, our negative self-beliefs. And so that book was all about kind of shifting how we see ourselves and also how we relate to food really being something to heal us and support us versus, you know, something that we grab for or try and fill maybe holes or needs or cravings in other ways, which are interesting. They're not all inherently bad. I think there's a place for everything, but yoga is for me what turns on the light. It's like, you know, going into your closet and picking out clothes in the dark or just turning it on and becoming aware of what I'm choosing, you know, so that I can actually pick, okay, maybe I don't care about how I feel tonight, but I'm enjoying some wine with some friends or something with some friends. And then other times, like, I really want to feel my best. So I'm feeding myself with good nutrition, but also good surroundings, the people, the environment, the, you know, the things I'm telling myself. It's all.
I think that's one of the most powerful statements you can make is that you're like, as Henry Ford says, if you believe you can or you can't, you're right. And you know, just going back to yoga, I remember sitting in a yoga class and just looking over at that 95-pound woman doing things that I just couldn't, you know, and I started to judge myself, starting to get that negative talk, like, why are you even here? What you're never going to get to this place. What are you going to do? And it's just the negative talk of the mind trying to, it's a negative bias that we all have in the mind of trying to get you out of something that it's uncomfortable doing. Cause it only does not care about your spiritual journey. It does not care about your anything. It only cares about protecting you in the way it thinks it should be protecting you. And that could be comfort zone scenario. You want to stay in that comfort zone until you can finally break free of what was like, if I'm sedentary for 30 years, a new workout routine is going to be extremely difficult to get started. You're going to have to break through for the, I think it's like 8 weeks or 16 weeks. If you can do it for a certain amount of time, it becomes your new norm. And if it becomes your new norm, then the mind starts like, no, let's gotta go work out. We gotta go do some yoga because it's now part of, okay, this is our new comfort zone. Okay. This is the new rules. Okay. This is where we are. It's just that first part. That's why diets are so difficult to get started and that whole concept in general. But it's about breaking through that and creating a new comfort zone for you. So your mind is a very powerful thing and it could, it's just like, it could be used for good or evil. I've said this on the show before, but I love saying this. Story. It's the cheesecake story. Have you ever heard of the cheesecake story? Mm-hmm. So one night you go to dinner and you eat a wonderful meal. You've stuffed yourself. You couldn't put another bite in your body. And then all of a sudden they wheel out the dessert tray and there's this beautiful piece of cheesecake. And then the self-talk starts happening. And this happens to everybody on the planet at one point or another in their life. Your talk's like, go ahead. It's going to be fine. You work out a little bit more. You'll be okay. Don't worry about it. Enjoy yourself. You deserve this. You've been working hard all week. All that. Just enjoy yourself tonight. And you're like, I do deserve this. I'm going to have my piece of cheesecake tonight. Damn it. I work hard. So then you eat your cheesecake and you enjoy it. And it's wonderful. And you go home that night. And as you're taking your clothes off in front of the mirror, that same person that was in your head said, "You fat pig. I can't believe you ate that cheesecake. Look it's at true. You." Right? It's like, that's the power of the mind. So once you understand that there is this person, this voice that really doesn't care either way, it's just about avoiding pain and gaining pleasure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care about your dreams. It doesn't care about anything that you're trying to achieve in life. It only cares about those two things. Then you can change the dynamic of the conversation and you can start controlling it a little bit more. It's not easy, not easy, but at least you're aware that there's a conversation.
Exactly. I think that's a big part of it, is it's kind of opening our eyes to notice these patterns. And maybe sometimes you want the cheesecake and that's fine. Other times you're like, you know, I just want to feel good and not crash at, you know, noon today because it's in the middle of the day or, but I think being able to notice that response and, you know, what I said before is have that curiosity to welcome it and befriend it, which is such a hard thing. It requires what you're talking about is kind of letting go of the attachment to the outcomes, this having this unbiased observer who's seeing things and kind of like, I always think of it as them like laughing at it because it's just our human tendency. It's not unique to any one of us. Like you said, we all just want to be happy and not suffer. And we're all struggling with, you know, the same things. And if we can kind of notice those patterns, it unlocks us. And, you know, obviously part of this idea of enlightenment is being able to do that maybe ongoing all the time. And I can't speak from that, but I can speak from, you know, having those moments of clarity where you can see that, having that moment in a meditation or in a yoga practice where you fold forward and you can't touch your toes and you don't freaking care. Like, interesting. That's an interesting sensation. I know for me, I've always been on the more flexible end, which made some of it easier, which isn't necessarily a good thing because you want some of that stuff to chew on. But I know when I go and do a lot of weights, there's something really nice about coming and having some of that resistance and feeling those sensations. We all have different things we like or don't like, but to be curious about it and to feel into it rather than to instantly judge it or try and push it away or fix it or tell a story about it, you know, we can just befriend it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think yoga is such a great analogy for life in so many ways, because you can get angry at the pose. I'm sure you've seen a few of those. You can get angry at the pose. Literally, I've seen people get angry at the pose, not them, like, who came up with this? This is impossible. This is built for you to just to fail. All of these kind of, because your ego can't handle it, so it has to lash out at the pose. That's the way it is. So you start getting angry at the pose, or you start looking. If you could just understand, I love what you said there. Just like, oh, that's an interesting sensation. If you can just accept it is what it is, and really truly into your inner soul, understand that it doesn't have a negative or a positive charge. It's what it is. A pose has no charge, no negative or positive charge to it. A yoga pose. It downward dog is downward dog. Cobra is cobra. Like that's, you know, that is what, you know, it is what it is.
And by the way, if you can do crow and you know, some of these fancy poses, but if you do crow and you're still an asshole when you leave your mat, like it didn't do any good.
It's pure ego. It's pure ego.
It is. And some of it can be a lot of tiptoes into that can be challenging. I think, again, it keeps coming back to, why am I doing this? Am I doing it to show off and to look great? Or am I doing it like, and to each your own, you know, I know in your 20s for me, it was always like, it was about dedication and discipline and going further. And that was an interesting challenge for me. And I do think there's a challenge for everyone because no one's good at all the poses. And so, you know, everyone has things that are hard for them. And for me, it's about relishing in the things that are challenging, because we know whether we're talking about physically or physiologically or mentally, that's where the growth is. That's where the potential is.
The concepts of the different perceptions of an event. So someone can look at a pose as a positive thing, and someone can look at a pose as a negative thing. So it's like a car accident. Mm-hmm. You know? I always use a car accident as an example. Car accident, the person who had the car accident, let's say everyone's safe, but someone who had a fender bender, oh my God, my life is over. I don't have the insurance. I don't have this or that. Now that person can look at that situation, which is what it is, by the way. The accident itself has no negative or positive charge. It's all about perception. But then you take it over to the dealership that's going to repair it. They're like, this is great.
Oh,
this
gosh.
Is great. So it's all about perception. So we are the ones that give a specific thing a negative or a positive charge. It's us. So if that's the case, and then I'll go really deep. If a tree falls in the forest, does it really make a sound? kind of concept. Like,
yeah.
Then you start going deeper and deeper. And I think, again, going back to yoga, it is such a great analogy for that, because if you in your yoga practice in the physical standpoint can let go of all of that and just be, that's the first step into getting to that higher place that we've been talking about.
It really is. And as a yoga teacher, I feel like it's seeds I plant all the time. And it's just a matter of, you know, whoever's in class being in the right place to take it in. But it really is such a big part of the practice, is letting go of our attachment to how the poses feel, allowing us to be. I often talk about it as like imagining yourself as a scientist in a laboratory. You know, you've got to take really good, clear notes. You know, you're really sensing and feeling and watching and observing and taking notes about everything. You're totally, hopefully, unbiased to the outcomes. You're not, you know, writing up a story about it yet until the end, maybe. But, you know, when you're in that process, when you're doing research, it's a really interesting thing if you can approach your practice like that as well. I think there's so much to it that it doesn't really matter what the pose looks like or, you know, what you're doing potentially, as long as there's kind of some of the underpinnings of the basic, you know, of a basic yoga practice in there somewhere, the mindfulness, right? The mindfulness, I think, is what really makes it yoga, rather than, you see so much of yoga showing up in the fitness realm now too, and other realms. Oh. And for me, it's the breath and the mindfulness that are really kind of the underpinnings that make it yoga.
And what you said earlier was really profound, is, why are you doing this?
Mm.
Why are you doing it? You know, are you doing it to show off? Are you doing it for an ego standpoint? Like, I can do that insane pose and nobody else in the class can, so obviously I'm better than everyone else. Is that your purpose? Or is it just like, I am here for the journey. I am open to what this experience is going to teach me, regardless of what pain I might be in or what sensations I might get.
And what I love about the yoga practice too, and a lot of the philosophy behind it, is that there's not even judgment about that. You know, if someone's in that place in their life where it's empowering to them and they get something out of it, and they're, you know, we're talking about ego-driven, I think often has this kind of negative context in the yoga world. It's kind of, it's hard not to put some judgment on it, but I think, you know, for us in the yoga world, it's not so much of like a good or a bad thing. Like, I'm happy if someone wants to come in and if they're into, you know, doing fancy stuff. And I just always assume that, you know, if they hang around long enough, they'll find something more, you know. You can't just go through the motions forever.
You're absolutely right. 20 years, you're not going to be doing this for the ego. Like, that's not a thing. It's just too hard. It's too hard to do. So you need to find something deeper. But that's life, though. Life is in general, you know, if we would have gotten everything we asked for in our 20s, we would have all died at one point or another. So I'm glad that I believe that there is some sort of universal, whatever you want to call it, kind of guiding us and not giving us everything we want when we want it. Can you imagine if we get everything we want when we when we asked for it? In our, we would have married the wrong person. We would have gotten the wrong job. We would have, like, it just the wrong career, gotten in the wrong school, whatever. It's very interesting, to say the least. Now, you've been teaching for so long and seen so many transformations, I'm assuming, in your journeys. What is the most inspirational transformation, physical, spiritual, mental, that you've seen in one of your students and or teachers that you've taught?
Gosh, that's a hard one, especially after 2 years of not seeing anyone in person.
So you got to go back in the archives.
I don't know that there's one that stands out. I mean, I've worked with thousands of people, but I think for me, you know, people love the flashy, fancy transformations, but for me, a transformation that kind of slowly works its way through all the different aspects of someone's life is the most interesting. You know, it's like whether they've had huge magical, you know, effects, or whether it's been something that's kind of slowly sunk into their lives. When I used to teach more, I don't teach a lot of local classes anymore. Most of what I do now is training teachers. But what I loved doing was seeing the people who studied with me over time, how they would grow and change and evolve, and how it snuck into their lives. I think the easy thing as a modern society for us to do are the quick, extreme transformations. We love the fast and fancy 30-day cleanse and detoxes and weight loss and whatever. But to me, from both a spiritual and a healthcare perspective, the things that really have an impact are the small things that we can stay with for years and decades. That's where we really see the potency. So I know that didn't totally answer your question, but...
Well, so you mean to tell me you can't get enlightenment in 30 days? Like, is that not a course that we can sell? I mean, I'll go in with you.
I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
I'm sure enlightenment in 30 days. You know, it's fascinating that, and I think you only get this as you get older, and it's not something you understand when you're young, and many people don't get it throughout their life, is that anything that's really worth having takes time, deep stuff, things that really mean something, a relationship, inner practice, a spiritual practice. These things take years. I mean, if you study, you know, Yogananda or any of the spiritual masters, they didn't just come out born enlightened. They went through some stuff, and they had to go, you know, Jesus was born and then he didn't show up until he was 30. So there was something going on between the birth and 30, you know? So they go through these things. And I think yoga is, again, a perfect example of that, great analogy for life, because you might start off not being able to do a downward dog, and 20 years later, not only can you do that, but you're at a whole other place. But it takes time, and you have to enjoy the journey, not the pose. Because if you're just hunting for the pose, you're gonna have a miserable time.
It's true. Yeah. And hopefully people are sensing that from, I think, some great discussions around that here. And, and, you know, the more you can reprioritize things, for me, purpose is everything. Whether I'm on my yoga mat, doing work, you know, whatever it is, I'm always trying to, you know, get really clear. It's the potency. In the end of it, you know, we only have so much time on this earth. My dad was just in the hospital last week. So that was a great reminder too of our humanness. And at the end of the day, you know, there's only so much time. And as you get older, you start to realize that, and having that clarity and what's important to us, whether that be on our mat, like, do I care about touching my toes? Do I care about doing these poses? And I think that's the gift of getting older too, is you don't really care so much about that or about what other people think. But what you really care more about is how you feel and how you're able to interact with people around you and support the people around you. You know, we all know, like, the oxygen mask, you know, we've got to take care of ourselves so that we can show up better and help the people around us and do our jobs better and appreciate our lives. And that's, to me, the essence. And so having that purpose, it's what I love about yoga, because there is you know, we've talked a little bit about the research, but there's so much research around a lot of different practices that can be really interesting, whether you're an athlete looking to enhance performance, or a woman trying to get pregnant or going through menopause, or someone who just wants to release stress and enjoy their life a little bit more. There's just so many different things that we can use yoga to help, help harness some of that innate resilience that we've been given and really appreciate our time on this planet more.
If I may quote the late great Betty White, when you're young, you dress to be sexy. In middle life, you dress for success. And as you get older, you dress for comfort.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And
that's yoga.
I mean, look, you want to talk about yoga pants? I mean, the pandemic, I don't know what the pandemic people would have done without yoga pants during the pandemic. Everybody was wearing them. Now, I wanted to ask you really quickly, what is Yoga Medicine and your company that you're doing?
So Yoga Medicine is my company. And basically what we do is we do a bunch of things now, but our main thing is training teachers in both the Eastern and Western concepts of the body. So they have a much deeper training than most. We do like 1,000 hours versus usually a teacher is maybe 200. Wow. And so they learn all about anatomy, physiology, pathology, as well as the traditional practices, the research, the crossovers between them, and really specifically how to support the healthcare industry. So how to work with doctors. Obviously we're not medical care, so we're not, although about a quarter of our teachers are also healthcare providers. They're some sort of medical background. Really what we're doing is just creating a resource of teachers who can work within the healthcare settings to support people who want to feel their best. And then we also have our online subscription, which is for people who don't necessarily have injuries or illness per se, anything significant. We all have stuff we're working on, but people who can go and now help themselves with these purpose-driven practices for, you know, we have anti-inflammatory practices based on that research I was talking about, or different recovery for athletes, or we've got stabilization and hips and, you know, all the stuff, all the things you can imagine, stress relief. We've got active practices and more passive and meditation. So it's kind of like you get to show up and pick what you feel you need so that you have that purpose-driven practice. And then we have a lot of resources on our sites. We have teacher trainings. We have classes and courses and podcasts and free stuff,
all sorts
as well
of
as
cool stuff.
Things you can get. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you a couple questions to ask all my guests. What is your mission in this life?
Oh gosh, my mission. I think my mission is really just to help support this crossover between yoga and the healthcare world. There is, you know, such a need for yoga within healthcare and a desire for it. And yet we all know it's kind of almost malpractice to refer someone out to yoga because they could be anywhere. They could be right. Jumping and hopping and handstanding, or they could be chanting or stretching or, you know, anything in between. And so being able to serve as a resource of kind of bridging that gap between not only East and West, but really specifically yoga and the medical world to provide a lot of resources for people. So.
And what is the ultimate purpose of life?
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to like go and sit and,
and meditate and maybe do a pose or two.
I mean, I think it's to each his own too. Again, it comes back to this purpose of what's important to you. For me, I think one of the most important things in life is really being present in the moments. We get so busy, and just that presence to me as a spiritual practice. It's a form of an offering to the person that we're maybe connecting with or speaking with to really be present with them. It's an offering to ourselves when we show up and we're present with ourselves, maybe on our yoga mat. But the potency, I think the appreciation for life is in that present moment awareness and our ability to really pour ourselves into it, to really take it in, because there's only so much.
Mm-hmm. And there's only so much time. There's only so much time. Tiffany, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about yoga. And hopefully the audience has a little bit better understanding of what yoga is, what it isn't, and see if it could help them along their spiritual journey and their life's journey as well. So I appreciate for everything you're doing, my dear. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure. Such a nice conversation. Thank you.
I want to thank Tiffany so much for coming on the show and sharing her knowledge and experience with all of us. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/066. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.